Hi, everybody.
Hi, Ruth.
The only line I'm sure of this morning is that my name is Ruth Weir and I am an alcoholic. And the only other thing I'm sure of is I better put my glasses on or I can't see you all. This is a lot of firsts for me here today. It's the first time in this part of the country, first time certainly at Mount Eagle, first time I've worn pants to Sunday prayer meeting. First time I've ever been asked to give a sermon, but don't be nervous, I have given the blessing. And after all, Franklin did save me on Friday night. Marcia continued the next morning, and Harold really wound it up last night, and I haven't got anything left to say. But really, I have, and lest I forget this, the most important thing I want to say this morning to you is thank you. There is a line in a favorite prayer of mine that I too often have forgotten lately because I've been fighting with God. He's winning. And that line is, renew in me a right spirit. And in these last 3 days here with you all at Mount Eagle, you have renewed in me a right spirit. You've expressed to me the deepest of fellowship and love. It's in your eyes, in your faces, in your actions, in your humor. It's everywhere. And one could not help but feel it. And I am deeply grateful. And you've done something else for me that is particularly wonderful for me at this time. All of you, but especially the speakers. And that is you've reviewed for me the bases upon which my sobriety is built, the simple but not easy program of recovery in AA. And for that, I am deeply grateful. My own story in its visible aspects is not a spectacular one. To the day I came into AA, I was described pretty much by the outside world as a competent, self-sufficient young businesswoman. My friends might have added to that that I was not a very happy person. But what all of those people who were not close to me did not realize was that this competent young businesswoman was a mess inside. My life was one of dealing in emotional excesses, so closely intertwined with my drinking that to this day it's the emotions I realize that I must watch if I am to continue in my sobriety one day at a time. I didn't know this then, of course. Life to me was not a very happy place. I wanted it to be, but I didn't know how to make it so. As Marcia spoke yesterday, it was a flashback for me and an identity for the first time, I might add, with Alateen. My father was or is an alcoholic, I really don't know. Let's say that in my childhood, he drank very alcoholically. And he was a violent drunk. Our furniture was out being repaired more often than it was at home. And ironically enough, I was the only member of the family who really hated him, and who never, never could forgive him until I came into AA. And so I have come to feel through the years of my sobriety that my alcoholism is God's greatest lesson and in a way God's greatest gift to me. I grew up with an awful lot of fears, and as I listened to Marcia yesterday, I strongly identified with the shame. I remember the taunts in the schoolyard after the whole neighborhood had seen Daddy taken off to jail because he got very raucous and loud. But I never for a moment thought the man was sick. I just thought he had nothing. And I didn't really know until I came into AA myself. I never really looked at that man and his good qualities until then. And I was 29 years old, or 28. I think I approached the drinking age with my dukes up. To me, it was not a social thing. It was something that made you be and do things you did not want to be and do. That's all I understood about it. And so when I started to drink, it was with great guard and concern, not about the drinking, but about what it might do to me. And in the beginning, from the very beginning, I never liked it when people kidded me about my drinking. I didn't think it was funny. And I was afraid that it was going to do the very thing that ultimately it did do, that it was going to control me. Above all, I wanted to be a lady. And in the end, by my standards, I was not. I set my standards for myself as a person far beyond what I could achieve. And I wept my way through 10 years over what I was not instead of being. Everybody else was prettier. Everybody else was more successful. Everybody else had talents that far exceeded mine. It never occurred to me to be grateful for what I was. I made it without the world knowing I was a mess, simply because from this very father that I hated so much, I had inherited a conscientiousness, an acceptance of hard work as a way of life. And it really was that saved me. But I know in time that too would have gone. I already began to see it. The excuses, the reasons why I wasn't doing a good job, the need to work overtime to compensate for my guilt on the days that I was only half there. I didn't know what happiness was. Other people seemed to have something of it. I don't even think I used the word very much in those days. But in my own sick state of mind, I decided to become the world's greatest tragedian. After all, I couldn't do anything else, I felt, as well as anyone else, so why not develop this? I hated Anna Magnani because she was the breast-beating type and she was stealing my act. And I really reached the point where I didn't trust happiness. It was a very elusive quality, and I couldn't trust it because it never came on my terms. And there was the whole thing. I was saying, give me life on my terms. And it didn't happen. I wrote the script. I chose the players. I limited myself terribly in so doing. My mind and my heart were not open. They were too closed in by fear. After I got sober, I came to realize a lot of the things that I thought I wasn't doing and that people expected me to do, those nameless theys, you know, my parents and anybody else that you really can't name, were things I really didn't want to do. I copped out for years on these things by saying I didn't have enough formal education. I was a high school graduate and hadn't gone beyond that. And this was my cop-out, you know. Well, you know, if I'd gone on, I could do so many more things. And it was just that. I was failing to see what work I was being given to do. There were a few saving graces that I was come to realize later on in my sobriety. And that is one, that I come from a highly critical, perhaps too critical family. My mother was excessively demanding of me, particularly. We were talking, Evelyn and I, about this yesterday, and I came to understand why, as I grew in my sobriety. I am my mother's daughter, and she was unable to see the good of herself in me. She only saw the character defects, and she was scared for me. I'm sure that was it. Now I understand that. I also know how to better deal with her, and I can help her more now than I ever could before. In my drinking years, I avoided calling her. And of course, the longer I avoided it, the more in Dutch I was, and the farther apart we grew. I never thought that my drinking had affected my family, really, because I had married when I was quite young and was divorced 2.5 years later, and I did not go back home. And in a way also I was punished for that. My parents were of the ilk that you did not stay away from home, and so I had to be punished in some way for that. And I was determined to make it on my own. I have that kind of resourcefulness. I could do it, but Mother really resented it. And years later was to say how wise I was. We could not have lived in the same household any longer. And so my life, particularly my last year of drinking, began to be one of a steady pattern, something like this. I wasn't a daily drinker. I started my alcoholic drinking being a binge drinker, really. And I would go home at night, weekends at first. And for those of you who may be here who think you're periodics, I can only say this. The periods grow closer together. The first time I found a means of escape over the weekend in alcohol with the sole idea of seeking oblivion, I had surrendered to my alcoholism. And that, by the way, was what alcohol was for me, an escape from life, a means of oblivion. It was never fun. And those periods grew closer together until that last year. I found the weekends much closer, and the drinking during the week certainly picking up. And I would go home at night having rationalized all the way up the street that after all I suffered from insomnia and therefore I deserved to drink the minute I got into the door. And you know the pattern. I would take the drink and lie down on the sofa bed in the living room that was closer to the kitchen. And then maybe I'd doze for a minute or two and I'd be back up again, and that set the pattern for the whole evening. And as I was practicing to be this great tragedian, I would set on the record player a whole stack of records, preferably Russian composers, because they're schmaltzy. And as I am Russian, I could weep the best to them. And I would drape myself on the sofa bed, with no one observing, by the way, but God. And I would commence to weep through the whole evening, alternated with sips of booze or beer or whatever I was drinking that night. Just simply wallowing in all of the problems I thought I had and I really couldn't name. And periodically I can recall this so well because one of the banes of my existence has always been that I wanted to look beautiful when I cry. You know, like the actresses. And so I can remember getting up once in a while and going to look in the mirror, and I looked like hell. And I still do, by the way. The only difference now is that when I cry, I have a reason. And I don't drag it out, and I don't rehearse it. And in those days, I was so mixed up that I really thought that if I stopped crying, then what I had started about wasn't important, so I would make myself go on with this thing, you see. But there was something that constantly nagged at me that from which I could never escape, and that was this voice that seemed to be saying to me, and I don't mean that in a literal sense, but you, Ruth Weir, have got to do the job of living for yourself. No one can do it for you. And no one can bring you your happiness. And I didn't want to know that. I wanted a knight in shining armor to come along and build a glass cage around me that was impenetrable and that would protect me from all hurt. And it was a fantasy world. Not too awfully long ago, when I said that to my doctor, he said something no one has ever said to me about that. He said, Ruth, that implies you wanted that person in the glass cage with you. And I said, oh my God, no, that's too close. And then I knew I'd grown up. And so when I finally called AA, having known nothing about it, having not known until the day I called that I was an alcoholic, I came copeless emotionally. I came as a child. I really had reached the point beyond which I could not go. I had no concept of what AA was all about. I only knew, as I walked down that path to Rosary Hall, that this was going to be a whole new way of life. And I was petrified. I knew it was going to mean an awful lot of work on myself, and I don't know where these thoughts came from, by the way, any more than I know, but yes, I do. It was God that got me to the telephone, because I didn't. But my fear was not about the drinking. I didn't have sense enough at that point, and I was too sick to be able to think about it. My fear was, did I have the resources upon which to draw in order to do the job I had to do, to be able to live with me and to be able to live in the world? Well, in the early days of my sobriety, I think practically everybody in this room has experienced the same thing. Harold told it beautifully last night in going through the big book for us. I came into AA in Cleveland, and it's very down-to-earth and very solid AA, and built a beautiful foundation for me in sobriety. They were kind, and they were loving, and they were firm. And somehow I knew within myself that I could not cut corners, that the disciplines had to start, if for no other reason than they had not been there because of the emotional excesses in which I had lived prior to this. And you were all my strength until I found some of my own. I don't know how this worked or when it started or when I began to feel a little bit like a mature gal, but it happened. The simple tools were put there, and most of all, what I was learning very slowly was to accept myself as I was, with all my limitations, which I'd never been able to accept, and with my strengths. And to know that I wasn't being asked to be a superhuman being, but just one little person. And to know that most of all, what was expected of me as a person was just that I be what I recognized myself as being. I came to know that, particularly in these last few years in the General Service Board, the Grapevine, that it really doesn't matter what the extent of my talents are. What is terribly important is that I recognize them as I have them and that I use them where I'm shown they're needed. I don't have to be a world beater. I never wanted to be, and now I can be comfortable because nobody is asking me to be. I do have to assume the responsibilities for sobriety, and that was terribly frightening in the beginning. To me, that means the responsibility for life. To me, that means caring about other people, not in tremendously big ways, but in all of the little ways that I was so good at forgetting when I was drinking. To me, it means looking with gratitude at what I am, instead of decrying what I am not. It means I'm able to weep if I'm hurt, and it means I can be hurt and have that freedom. And it means I can come to any one of you, and I know I could, and tell you what that hurt is, and let you help me with it from your own experience. And it means that I have to have the kind of responsibility that says, okay, now we've talked about it enough. I'll take it in, and then gradually, as I can, I will surrender it. And it means that I have the right to be wrong and admit that I am wrong. And it means that I can learn what Sister Ignatia told me I would learn, and I couldn't believe, I remember I cried when she said this. She said that alcoholics live on an emotional, constant emotional upheaval, something like this, I can remember her saying. And I identified with this, particularly in the end, when I was usually down here. And she said, but you can learn to live like this. And I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it was possible. But I have, with a few excursions every now and then. I still tend to be like, you know, nurse my wrath to keep it warm. I still tend to like to kind of hang on to things and chew them a while and too hard. Because I realize that my character defects are like everything else. They're like my drinking. They're just arrested. We talked about being saved, and we laughed about this, but there was something I learned in joining a church a few years back. This word salvation bugged me, the idea that Christ came once and saved us and so on, and I began to realize that salvation is a continuing thing. It's a very churchy word, I realize, but it is a continuing thing, and what it means to me is that no matter how often I fail, no matter how often I stub my toe, so long as I am willing to look up and reach out, I will be saved again. And so while we've laughed about it, it brought back a new meaning to me this time. You all in AA have given me a commitment to life from which I cannot escape. I have never wanted to drink since I came into the program 16 years ago. But there have been times when I've wanted to escape from life. There have been times when I thought I couldn't survive a particular disappointment. And Harold was to remind me last night that there is nothing that cannot be overcome. But there is one thing that has always stayed with me. For myself most of all, but because of you, and all you have given me and taught me about life, I must always go on. But not just go on as if it were a burden, but really enjoy. In the days that I drank, if there was a problem, it permeated my whole life, my whole being. It suffused, it took over. And now it doesn't that way anymore. I can be hurting terribly inside. But the strength comes from the fact that I know, even in my clumsy way, I'm working on it. And as I walk out the door of my apartment, I have a commitment to being kind to even the guy or gal on the bus or the subway. And that ain't easy in New York. So I have come to know that life will have its problems. And this, I say particularly for the persons here today who may be newer in their sobriety. I think sometimes those of us who've been around for a while must come on sounding like we've got it made. We get in gatherings like this and we're all happy and smiley and, you know, it's a fun time. And we who've been around for a while, forget to share with you the stumbling blocks along the way. We forget to share not just our drinking story, but our living experience with you. And I hope I've done a little bit of that this morning. It isn't always easy. Somewhere once I read words that Clifton Fadiman wrote about the coming of Christ, and he said the coming of Christ brought with it a promise, not a solution. And I remember this was shortly after I got sober, and I thought, yes, that's what AA is. It is a promise that if you take the tools offered to you, you too can have sobriety and a useful way of life. But it doesn't say, as that current song does, I think that too applies here. I beg your pardon, I've never promised you a rose garden. It doesn't. But it does say that anything is possible within each of our own strengths and limitations, within our own boundaries, and it broadens those boundaries. And it does say you're never alone again. And that you don't have to be afraid that because you've been 10 years sober, you're suddenly faced with a problem you're not able to handle too well. It says then that sobriety is a continuing thing, and life is a continuing growing process. And you come back and you reach out just as you did those first few days of sobriety. And I think we older people around should remember that. Share our pains, share our joys, and share most of all what certainly I have learned, that they do come from the same well, and that neither one can overtake you. You've all had that marvelous experience after being sober a while of experiencing Christmas, and it's wonderful and it's fun, but it isn't that excess, that kind of ecstasy that you couldn't handle in your drinking days. It's just another day that was beautiful and nice, and it's gone into tomorrow. And you take up the next day, and it's just as good. And that's what it's all about, I think, for me. And I know that so long as I stay close to God, even when I'm fighting with Him, and to AA, that within my own strengths and my own limitations, perhaps I can do the job that I'm intended to do. Thank you so much for having me here.